Chapter 11. A Hell in Mataran. Despite the late hours kept by everyone that night, the show made a very early start the next morning. Grainy-eyed and groggy, Matt trudged out of his tent while the sky was still dark to find men and women with lanterns trotting to get ready when they were not running, and nearly everyone shouting for somebody or other to move faster. Many had the unsteady step of people who had not slept. Everyone seemed to feel that the farther they could get from where that village had vanished in front of their eyes, the better. Luca's great gaudy wagon took to the road before the sun had cleared the horizon, and once again he set a goodly pace. Two merchants' trains of 20 or so wagons each passed them, heading south, and a slow caravan of tinkers, but nothing going the other way. The farther, the better. Matt rode with Tuon, and Seleucia made no attempt to put the dun between them, yet there was no conversation, however much he tried to start one. Save for an occasional unreadable glance when he made a sally or told a joke, Tuon rode looking straight ahead, the cowl of her blue cloak hiding her face. Even juggling failed to catch her attention. There was something broody about her silence, and it worried him. When a woman went silent on you, there usually was trouble in the offing. When she brooded, you could forget about usually. He doubted it was the village of the dead that had her fretting. She was too tough for that. No, there was trouble ahead. Little more than an hour after they set out, a farm on rolling ground hove into sight, with dozens of black-faced goats cropping grass in a wide pasture and a large olive grove. Boys weeding among the rows of dark-leaved olive trees dropped their hoes and rushed down to the stone fences to watch the show pass, shouting with excitement to know who they were and where they were going and where coming from. Men and women came out of the sprawling tile-roofed farmhouse and two big thatch-roofed barns, shading their eyes to watch. Matt was relieved to see it. The dead paid no mind to the living. As the show rolled onward, farms and olive groves grew thicker on the ground until they ran side by side, pushing the forest back a mile or more on either side of the road. And well short of mid-morning, they reached a prosperous town somewhat larger than Jurador. A merchant's long train of canvas-topped wagons was turning in at the main gates, where half a dozen men in polished conical helmets and leather coats sewn with steel discs stood guard with halberds. More men, cradling crossbows, kept watch atop the two gate towers. But if the lord of Mataran, one Nathan Sarmain Vendare, expected trouble, the guards were the only sign of it. Farms and olive groves reached right to the stone walls of Mataran, an unsound practice, and right costly should the town ever need to be defended. Luca had to bargain with the farmer for the right to set up the show in an unused pasture and came back muttering that he had just bought the scoundrel a new flock of goats, or maybe two. But the canvas wall was soon rising, with Luca chivying everyone for speed. They were to perform today and leave early in the morning. Very early. Nobody complained or much said an unneeded word. The further, the better.
"And tell no one what you saw," Luca cautioned more than once. "We saw nothing out of the ordinary. We wouldn't want to frighten the patrons away."
People looked at him as if he were insane. No one wanted to think of that melting village or the peddler, much less speak of them. Matt was sitting in his tent, in his shirt sleeves, waiting for Tom and Julian to return from their trip into the town to learn whether there was a Seanchan presence. He was idly tossing a set of dice on his small table. After an early run of mostly high numbers, five single pips stared up at him 10 times in a row. Most men thought the Dark One's eyes an unlucky toss. Seleucia pulled back the entry flap and strode in. Despite her plain brown divided skirts and white blouse, she managed to seem a queen entering a stable. A filthy stable, by the expression on her face, the Lopin and Nerim could have satisfied his mother when it came to cleaning.
"She wants you," she drawled peremptorily, touching her flowered scarf to make sure her short yellow hair was covered. "Come."
"What's she want with me, then?" he said, and leaned his elbows on the table. He even stretched out his legs and crossed his ankles. Once you let a woman think you would jump whenever she called, you never got out from under again.
"She'll tell you. You're wasting time, Toy. She won't be pleased."
"If Precious expects me to come running when she crooks a finger, she better learn to like being displeased." Grimacing, If her mistress tolerated the name, Seleucia took it for a personal affront. She folded her arms beneath that impressive bosom. It was clear as good glass that she intended to wait there until he went with her, and he was of a mind to make it a long wait. He tossed the dice, the Dark One's eyes, expecting him to jump when Tuan said toad. Ha! Another toss, spinning across the table, one die nearly going over the edge. The Dark One's eyes. Still, he had nothing else to do at the moment. Even so, he took his time donning his coat, a good bronze-colored silk. By the time he picked up his hat, he could hear her foot tapping impatiently. "Well, what are you waiting for?" he asked. She hissed at him. She held the entry flap open, but she purely hissed like a cat. Setala and Tuan were sitting on one of the beds, talking, when he entered the purple wagon, but they cut off the instant he stepped through the door and gave him brief but appraising looks, which told him the subject of their talk had been Matt Cawthon. It made his hackles rise. Plainly, whatever Tuan wanted was something they thought he would disapprove of. And just as plainly, she meant to have it anyway. The table was snug against the ceiling, and Seleucia brushed past him to take a place behind Tuan as the tiny woman sat down on the stool, her face stern and those beautiful big eyes steady. "Hang all the prisoners immediately."
"I wish to visit the common room of an inn," she announced, "or a tavern. I have never seen the inside of either. You will take me to one in this town, Toy."
He let himself breathe again. "That's easy enough. Just as soon as Tom or Julin lets me know it's safe."
"It must be a low place. What is called a hell."
His mouth fell open. Low? Hells were the lowest of the low. Dirty and dimly lit, where the ale and wine were cheap and still not worth half what you paid. The food was worse, and any woman who sat on your lap was trying to pick your pocket or cut your purse or else had two men waiting upstairs to crack you over the head as soon as you walked into her room. At any hour of the day or night, you would find dice rolling in a dozen games, sometimes for surprising stakes given the surroundings. Not gold, only a stone fool displayed gold in a hell, but silver often crossed the tables. Few of the gamblers would have come by their coin by any means even halfway honest, and those few would be as hard-eyed as the headcrackers and knifemen who preyed on drunks in the night. Hells always had two or three strong arms with cudgels about to break up fights, and most days they worked hard for their pay. They usually stopped the patrons from killing one another, but when they failed, the corpse was dragged out the back and left in an alley somewhere or on a rubbish heap. And while they were dragging, the drinking never slowed or the gambling either. That was a hell. How had she even heard of such places? "Did you plant this fool notion in her head?" he demanded of Setala.
"Why, what in the light makes you think that?" she replied, going all wide-eyed the way women did when pretending to be innocent,
or when they wanted you to think they were pretending, just to confuse you. He could not see why they bothered. Women confused him all the time without trying.
"It's out of the question, precious. I walk into a hell with a woman like you, and I'll be in 6 knife fights inside the hour, if I survive that long."
Tuan gave a pleased smile. Just a flicker, but definitely pleased.
"Do you really think so?"
"I know so for a fact." Which produced another brief smile of delight. Delight! The bloody woman wanted to see him in a knife fight.
"Even so, Toy, you promised."
They were arguing over whether he had made a promise. Well, he was calmly presenting the logic that saying something was easy was no promise. Tuan just stubbornly insisted he had promised, while Setala took up her embroidery hoop and Seleucia watched him with the amused air of someone watching a man try to defend the indefensible. And he did not shout, no matter what Tuan said, when a knock came at the door. Tuan paused.
"You see, Toy," she said after a moment, "that is how it is done. You knock, and then wait."
She made a simple gesture over one shoulder at her maid.
"You may enter the presence," Seleucia called, drawing herself up regally.
She probably expected whoever came in to prostrate themselves. It was Tom, in a dark blue coat and dark gray cloak, that would make him unremarked in any common room or tavern, neither well-to-do nor poor. A man who could afford to pay for his own drink while listening to the gossip, or buy another man a cup of wine to pay for hearing his news and the latest rumors. He did not prostrate himself, but he did make an elegant bow despite his bad right leg.
"My lady,"
he murmured to Tuon before turning his attention to Matt.
"Harnan said he saw you strolling this way. I trust I'm not interrupting. I heard voices."
Matt scowled. He had not been shouting. "You're not interrupting. What did you find out?"
"That there may be Shonchan in the town from time to time. No soldiers, but it seems they're building 2 farm villages a few miles to the north of the road and 3 more a few miles south. The villagers come to town to buy things now and then."
Matt managed to keep from smiling as he spoke over his shoulder. He even got a smattering of regret into his voice.
"I'm afraid there's no jaunt into Matarin for you, precious. Too dangerous."
Tuon folded her arms, emphasizing her bosom.
There were more curves to her than he had once thought. Not like Seleucia, certainly, but nice curves. "Farmer's toy," she drawled dismissively. "No farmer has ever seen my face. You promised me a tavern or a common room, and you won't escape on this puny excuse."
"A common room should present no difficulties," Tom said. "It's a pair of scissors or a new pot these farmers are after, not drink. They make their own ale, it seems, and don't much like the local brew."
"Thank you, Tom," Matt said through gritted teeth. "She wants to see a hell."
The white-haired man gave a wheezing cough and knuckled his mustaches vigorously.
"A hell?" he muttered.
"A hell. Do you know a hell in this town where I might take her without starting a riot?"
He intended the question for sarcasm, but Tom surprised him by nodding.
"I might just know a place at that," the man said slowly. "The White Ring. I intend to go there anyway, to see what news I can pick up."
Matt blinked. However unremarked Tom might be elsewhere, he would be looked at askance in a hell wearing that coat. More than askance. The usual garb there was coarse, dirty wool and stained linen. Besides, asking questions in a hell was a good way to have a knife planted in your back. But maybe Tom meant that this White Ring was not a hell at all. Tuon might not know the difference if the place were only a little rougher than the usual.
"Should I get Harnan and the others?" he asked, testing.
"Oh, I think you and I should be protection enough for the lady," Tom said, with what might have been the ghost of a smile,
and knots loosened in Matt's shoulders.
He still cautioned the 2 women.
There was no question of Seleucia staying behind, of course. Mistress Annan refused Tuon's invitation to accompany them, saying she had already seen as many hells as she had any wish to, about keeping their hoods well up. Tuon might believe no farmer had ever seen her face, but if a cat could gaze on a king, as the old saying said, then a farmer might have gazed on Tuon some time or other, and it would be just their luck to have 1 or 2 of them turn up in Matarin. Being Tavirin usually seemed to twist the pattern for the worst in his experience.
"Toy,"
Tuon said gently, as Seleucia settled the blue cloak on her slim shoulders.
"I have met many farmers while visiting the country, but they very properly kept their eyes on the ground, even if I allowed them to stand. Believe me, they never saw my face."
"Oh." He went to fetch his own cloak and his hat. White clouds nearly obscured the sun, still short of its midday peak, and it was a brisk day for spring, with a strong breeze to boot. People from the town crowded the main street of the show, men in rough woolens or sober coats of finer stuff with just a touch of embroidery on the cuffs, women, many wearing lace caps and somber collared dresses beneath long white aprons or dark high-necked dresses with embroidery curling across the bosom, children darting everywhere, escaping their parents and being chased down, all of them oohing and aahing at Miora's leopards or Latel's bears, at the jugglers or Balat and Abar eating fire, the lean brothers moving in unison. Not pausing for so much as a glimpse of the female acrobats, Matt threaded through the throng with Tuon on his arm, which he assured by placing her hand on his left wrist. She hesitated a moment, then nodded slightly, a queen giving assent to a peasant. Tomet offered his arm to Seleucia, but she stayed at her mistress's left shoulder. At least she did not try to crowd between. Luca, in scarlet coat and cloak, was beneath the big banner at the entrance, watching coins clink into the glass pitcher, clink again as they were dropped into the strongbox. He wore a smile on his face. The line waiting to get in stretched near 100 paces along the canvas wall, and more people were trickling out of the town, heading toward the show.
"I could take in a fine bit here over 2 or 3 days," he told Matt. "After all, this place is solid, and we're far enough from..."
His smile flickered out like a snuffed candle.
"You think we're far enough, don't you?"
Matt sighed. Gold would defeat fear every time in Vallonluca. He could not hold his cloak closed with Tuam on his arm, so it flared behind him in the stiff breeze, yet that was to the good. The gate guards, slouching in a ragged line, eyed them curiously, and one made a sketchy bow. Silk and lace had that effect, with country armsmen, at least. And that was what these men were, no matter how brightly they had burnished their helmets and coin-armor coats. Most leaned on their halberds like farmers leaning on shovels. But Tom stopped, and Matt was forced to halt, too, a few paces into the town. After all, he had no idea where the White Ring lay.
"A heavy guard, Captain," Tom said, worry touching his voice. "Are there brigands in the area?"
"No outlaws around here," a grizzled guard said gruffly.
A puckered white scar slanting across his square face combined with a squint to give him a villainous appearance. He was not one of the leaners, and he held his halberd as if he might know how to use it.
"The Shanshan cleaned out the few we hadn't caught. Move along now, old fellow. You're blocking the way."
There was not a wagon or cart in sight, and the few people leaving the town afoot had plenty of room. The gate arch was wide enough for 2 wagons abreast, though it might be a squeeze.
"The Shanshan said we didn't set enough guards,"
a stocky fellow about Matt's age put in cheerfully.
"And Lord Nathan listens close when the Shanshan talk."
The grizzled man clouted him with a gauntleted hand on the back of his helmet hard enough to stagger him.
"You watch your mouth with people from off, Kyler," the older man growled. "Else you'll be back behind a plow before you can blink. My lord," he added to Matt, raising his voice, "you want to call your servant before he gets himself in trouble?"
"My apologies, Captain,"
Tom said humbly, ducking his white head, the very image of a chastened serving man.
"No offense meant. My apologies."
"He would have thumped you, too, if I hadn't been there," Matt told him when he caught up. Tom was limping noticeably. He must have been tired for it to show that much. "He almost did anyway. And what did you learn that was worth risking that?"
"I wouldn't have asked without you in that coat," Tom chuckled as they walked deeper into the town. "The first lesson is what questions to ask. The second, and just as important, is when and how to ask. I learned there aren't any brigands, which is always good to know, though I've heard of very few bands big enough to attack something as large as the show. I learned Nathan is under the Shanshan thumb. Either he's obeying a command with those extra guards, or he takes their suggestions as commands. And most important, I learned that Nathan's armsmen don't resent the Shanshan."
Matt quirked an eyebrow at him.
"They didn't spit when they said the name, Matt. They didn't grimace or growl. They won't fight the Shanshan, not unless Nathan tells them to, and he won't."
Tom exhaled heavily.
"It's very strange. I've found the same everywhere, from Ebu Dar to here. These outlanders come, take charge, impose their laws, snatch up women who can channel, and if the nobles resent them, very few among the common people seem to. Unless they've had wife or relation collared, anyway. Very strange. And it bodes ill for getting them out again. But then Altara is Altara. I'll wager they're finding a colder reception in Amadisia and Terabon."
He shook his head.
"We had best hope they are, else..."
He did not say what else, but it was easy to imagine. Matt glanced at Tuon. How did she feel hearing Tom talk about her people so? She said nothing, only walked at his side, peering curiously at everything from the shelter of her cowl. Tile-roofed buildings, 3 and 4 stories tall, most of brick, lined the wide stone-paved main street of Matarin. Shops and inns with signs that swung in the stiff breeze crowded in beside stables and rich people's homes, with large lamps above the arched doorways, and humbler structures that housed poorer folk, by the laundry hanging from nearly every window. Horse carts and hand barrows, laden with bales or crates or barrels, slowly made their way through a moderately thick throng, men and women with brisk strides, full of that storied southern industry, children dashing about in games of catch. Tuan studied it all with equal interest. A fellow pushing a wheeled grindstone and crying that he sharpened scissors or knives till they could cut wishes caught her attention as much as a lean, hard-faced woman in leather trousers, with 2 swords strapped to her back. Doubtless a merchant's guard or perhaps a hunter for the horn, but a rarity either way. A buxom Damani in a clinging red dress that fell just short of transparent, with a pair of bulky bodyguards and scale-armor jerkins at her back, got neither more nor less study than a lanky one-eyed fellow in frayed wool hawking pins, needles, and ribbons from a tray. He had not noticed this sort of curiosity from her in Jurador, but she had been intent on finding silk in Jurador. Here she seemed to be trying to memorize all she saw. Tom soon led them off into a maze of twisting streets, most of which deserved the name only because they were paved with rough stone blocks the size of a man's 2 fists. Buildings as big as those on the main street, some housing shops on the ground floor, loomed over them, almost shutting out the sky. Many of those ways were too narrow for horse carts. In some, Matt would not have had to extend his arms fully to touch the walls on either side. And more than once he had to press Tuan against the front of a building to let a heavy-loaded hand-barrow rumble past over the uneven paving stones, the barrow man calling apologies for the inconvenience without slowing. Porters trudged through that cramped warren, too, men walking bent nearly parallel to the ground, each with a bale or crate on his back held level by a padded leather roll strapped to his hips. Just the sight of them made Matt's own back ache. They reminded him how much he hated work. He was on the point of asking Tom how far they had to go, Matarin was not that big a town, when they reached the White Ring, on one of those winding streets where his arms could more than compass the width of the pavement, a brick building of 3 floors across from a cutler's shop. The painted sign hanging over the inn's red door, a frilly white circle of lace, made the knots return to his shoulders. Ring, it might be called, but that was a woman's garter if he ever had seen one. It might not be a hell, but inns with signs like that usually were rowdy enough in their own right. He eased the knives up his coat sleeves and those in his boot tops as well, felt the blades under his coat, shrugged just to get the feel of the one hanging behind his neck. Though if it went that far, Tuan nodded approvingly. The bloody woman was dying to see him get into a knife fight. Seleucia had the sense to frown.
Ah, yes, Tom said, a wise precaution.
And he checked his own knives, tightening those knots in Matt's shoulders a little more. Tom carried almost as many blades as he did, up his sleeves, beneath his coat. Seleucia writhed her fingers at Tuan, and suddenly they were in a silent argument, fingers flashing. Of course, it could not be that. Tuan bloody well owned Seleucia, the same as owning a dog, and you did not argue with your dog. But an argument it seemed, both women with their jaws set stubbornly. Finally, Seleucia folded her hands and bowed her head in acquiescence. A reluctant submission. It will be well, Tuan told her in a jollying tone. You will see, it will be well. Matt wished he was sure of that. Taking a deep breath, he extended his wrist for her hand again and followed Tom. The spacious, wood-paneled common room of the White Ring held better than 2 dozen men and women, nearly half obvious outlanders, at square tables beneath a thick-beamed ceiling. All neatly dressed in finely woven wool, with little by way of ornamentation, most were talking quietly over their wine in pairs, cloaks draped over their low-backed chairs, though 3 men and a woman with long beaded braids were tossing bright red dice from a wine cup at one table. Pleasant smells drifted from the kitchen, including meat roasting, goat most likely. Beside the wide stone fireplace, where a parsimonious fire burned, and a polished brass barrel clock sat on the mantel, a saucy-eyed young woman who rivaled Seleucia, and with her blouse unlaced nearly to her waist to prove it, swayed her hips and sang, accompanied by a hammered dulcimer and a flute, a song about a woman juggling all of her lovers. She sang in a suitably bawdy voice. None of the patrons appeared to be listening. As I walked out one fine spring day, I met young Jack, who was pitching hay. His hair so fair and his eyes were too. Well, I gave him a kiss. Oh, what could I do? We snuggled and we tickled while the sun rose high, and I won't say how often he made me sigh. Lowering her hood, Tuan stopped just inside the door and frowned around the room. "Are you certain this is a hell, Master Marilyn?" she asked. In a low voice, thank the light. Some places a question of that sort could get you thrown out, and roughly, silk coat or no. In others, the price is just doubled.
"I assure you, you won't find a bigger collection of thieves and rascals anywhere in Matarin at this hour," Tom murmured, stroking his mustaches.
"Now Jack gets an hour when the sky is clear, and Willie gets an hour when my father's not near. It's the hayloft with Morrel, for he shows no fear, and Kylan comes at midday. He's oh so bold. Lord Brelan gets an evening when the night is cold. Master Andrew gets a morning, but he's very old. Oh, what is a poor girl to do? My loves are so many and the hours so few." Tuan looked doubtful, but with Seleucia at her shoulder, she walked over to stand in front of the singer, who faltered a moment at Tuan's intense scrutiny before catching the song up again. She sang over the top of Tuan's head, plainly attempting to ignore her. It seemed that with every other verse, the woman in the song added a new lover to her list. The male musician, playing the dulcimer, smiled at Seleucia and got a frosty stare back. The two women got other looks as well, the one so small and with very short black hair, the other rivaling the singer, and with her head wrapped in a scarf, but no more than glances. The patrons were intent on their own business.
"It isn't a hell," Matt said softly, "but what is it? Why would so many people be here in the middle of the day?"
It was mornings and evenings when common rooms filled up like this.
"The locals are selling olive oil, lacquerware, or lace," Tom replied just as quietly, "and the outlanders are buying. It seems local custom is to begin with a few hours of drink and conversation. And if you have no head for it," he added dryly, "you sober up to find you've made much less of a bargain than you thought in your wine."
"Like, Tom, she'll never believe this place is a hell. I thought you were taking us somewhere merchants' guards drink or apprentices. At least she might believe that."
"Trust me, Matt, I think you'll find she has lived a very sheltered life in some ways."
"Sheltered? When her own brothers and sisters tried to kill her?"
"You wouldn't care to wager a crown on it, would you?"
Tom chuckled.
"Always glad to take your coin."
Tuan and Seleucia came gliding back, faces expressionless.
"I expected rougher garb on the patrons," Tuan said quietly, "and perhaps a fight or two, but the song is too salacious for a respectable inn, though she is much too covered to sing it properly, in my opinion. What is that for?" she added in tones of suspicion as Matt handed Tom a coin.
"Oh," Tom said, slipping the crown into his coat pocket, "I thought you might be disappointed that only the more successful blackguards were present. They aren't always so colorful as the poorer sort. But Matt said you'd never notice."
She leveled a look at Matt, who opened his mouth indignantly, and closed it again. What was there to say? He was already in the pickling kettle. No need to stoke the fire. As the innkeeper approached, a round woman with suspiciously black hair beneath a white lace cap, stuffed into a gray dress embroidered in red and green across her more than ample bosom, Tom slipped away with a bow and murmured,
"By your leave, my lord, my lady."
Murmured, but loud enough for Mistress Highland to hear. The innkeeper had a flinty smile, yet she exercised it for a lord and lady, curtsying so deeply that she grunted, straightening back up, and she seemed only a little disappointed that Matt wanted wine and perhaps food, not rooms. Her best wine. Even so, when he paid, he let her see that he had gold in his purse as well as silver. A silk coat was all very well, but gold-wearing rags got better service than copper-wearing silk.
"Ale," Tuan drawled. "I've never tasted ale. Tell me, good mistress, is it likely any of these people will start a fight any time soon?"
Matt nearly swallowed his tongue. Mistress Hyland blinked and gave her head a small shake, as if uncertain she really had heard what she thought she had.
"No need to worry, my lady," she said. "It happens time to time if they get too far in their cups. But I'll settle them down hard if it does."
"Not on my account," Tuan told her. "They should have their sport."
The innkeeper's smile went crooked and barely held, but she managed another curtsy, then scurried away, clutching Matt's coin and calling,
"Jera, wine for the lord and lady, a pitcher of Caranile, and a mug of ale."
"You mustn't ask questions like that, precious," Matt said quietly as he escorted Tuan and Seleucia to an empty table. Seleucia refused a chair, taking Tuan's cloak and draping it over the chair she held for Tuan, then standing behind it.
"It isn't polite. Besides, it lowers your eyes."
Thank the light for those talks with Aginan, whatever name she wanted to go by. Shan Chen would do any fool thing or refuse to do what was sensible to avoid having their eyes lowered. Tuan nodded thoughtfully.
"Your customs are often very peculiar, Toy. You will have to teach me about them. I have learned some, but I must know the customs of the people I will rule in the name of the Empress. May she live forever."
"I'll be glad to teach you what I can," Matt said, unpinning his cloak and letting it fall carelessly over the low back of his chair. "It will be good for you to know our ways, even if you end up ruling a sight less than you expect to." He set his hat on the table. Tuan and Seleucia gasped as one, hands darting for the hat. Tuan's reached it first, and she quickly put it on the chair next to her.
"That is very bad luck, Toy. Never put a hat on a table."
She made one of those odd gestures for warding off evil, folding under the middle two fingers and extending the other two stiffly. Seleucia did the same.
"I'll remember that," he said dryly.
Perhaps too dryly. Tuan gave him a level look, very level.
"I have decided you will not do for a cupbearer, Toy, not until you learn meekness, which I almost despair of teaching you. Perhaps I will make you a running groom instead. You are good with horses. Would you like trotting at my stirrup when I ride? The robes are much the same as for a cupbearer, but I will have yours decorated with ribbons. Pink ribbons."
He managed to maintain a smooth face, but he felt his cheeks growing hot. There was only one way she could know pink ribbons had any special significance to him. Tylin had told her. It had to be. Burn him, women would talk about anything. The arrival of the serving maid with their drink saved him from having to make any response. Jera was a smiling young woman with nearly as many curves as the singer, not so well displayed, yet not really concealed by the white apron she wore tied snugly. Her dark woolen dress fit quite snugly, too. Not that he gave her more than a glance, of course. He was with his wife-to-be. Anyway, only a complete woolhead looked at a woman while with another. Jera placed a tall pewter wine pitcher and two polished pewter cups on the table and handed a thick mug of ale to Seleucia, then blinked in confusion when Seleucia transferred the mug to Tuan and took a cup of wine in return. He handed her a silver penny to settle her discomposure, and she gave him a beaming smile with her curtsy before darting off to another call from the innkeeper. It was unlikely she received much in the way of silver.
"You could have smiled back at her, Toy," Tuan said, holding the mug up for a sniff and wrinkling her nose. "She is very pretty. You were so stone-faced, you probably frightened her."
She took a sip, and her eyes widened in surprise.
"This is actually quite good."
Matt sighed and took a long swallow of dark wine that smelled faintly of flowers. In none of his memories, his own or those other men's, could he recall having understood women. Oh, one or two things here and there, but never anywhere near completely. Sipping her ale steadily, He was not about to tell her ale was taken in swallows, not sips. She might get herself drunk deliberately just to experience a hell fully. He was not ready to put anything past her today. Or any day. Taking sips between every sentence, the maddening little woman questioned him on customs. Telling her how to behave in a hell was easy enough. Keep to yourself, ask no questions, and sit with your back to a wall if you could, and near to a door in case of a need to leave suddenly. Better not to go at all, but if you had to. Yet she quickly passed on to courts and palaces, and got few answers there. He could have told her more of customs in the courts of Aharon or Shiota, or a dozen other dead nations, than in those of any nation that still lived. Scraps of how things were done in Camelon and Tyr were all he really knew, and bits from Faldara in Shinar. Well, that in Ebu Dar, but she already knew those ways.
So you have traveled widely and been in other palaces than the Tarasen, she said finally, and took the last bit of ale in her mug.
He had not finished half his wine yet. He thought Seleucia had not taken above 2 small swallows of hers.
But you are not nobly born, it seems. I thought you must not be.
That I am not, he told her firmly. Nobles... He trailed off, clearing his throat. He could hardly tell her nobles were fools with their noses so high in the air they could not see where they were stepping. She was who and what she was, after all. Expressionless, Tuon studied him while pushing her empty mug to one side. Still studying, she flickered the fingers of her left hand over her shoulder, and Seleucia clapped her own hands together loudly. Several of the other patrons looked at them in surprise.
"You called yourself a gambler," Tuon said, "and Master Merlin named you the luckiest man in the world."
Jera came running, and Seleucia handed her the mug.
"Another, quickly," she commanded, though not in an unkindly way.
Still, she had a regal manner to her. Jera dropped a hasty curtsy and scurried off again as though she had been shouted at.
"I have luck sometimes," Matt said cautiously. "Let's see whether you have any today, Toy."
Tuon looked toward the table where the dice were rattling on the tabletop. He could see no harm in it. It was a certainty he would win more than he lost, yet he thought it unlikely one of the merchants would pull a knife, however much his luck was in. He had not noticed anyone carrying one of those long belt knives that everybody wore farther south. Standing, he offered Tuon his arm, and she rested her hand lightly on his wrist. Seleucia left her wine on the table and stayed close to her mistress. 2 of the Altaran men, one lean and bald except for a dark fringe, the other round-faced, above 3 chins, scowled when he asked whether a stranger might join the game, and the third, a graying stocky fellow, with a pendulous lower lip, went stiff as a fence post. The Terrabonner woman was not so unfriendly.
Of course, why not? She said, her speech slightly slurred.
Her face was flushed, and the smile she directed at him had a slackness about it. Apparently she was one of those with no head for wine. It seemed the locals wanted to keep her happy because the scowls vanished, though the graying man remained wooden-faced. Matt fetched chairs from a nearby table for himself and Tuon. Seleucia chose to remain standing behind Tuon, which was just as well. 6 people crowded the table. Jera arrived to curtsy and proffer a refilled mug to Tuon with both hands and a murmured "Milady," and another serving woman, graying and nearly as stout as Mistress Hylan, replaced the wine pitcher on the gambler's table. Smiling, the bald man filled the Terrabonner's cup to the brim. They wanted her happy and drunk. She drained half the cup and with a laugh wiped her lips delicately with a lace-edged handkerchief. Getting it back up her sleeve required 2 tries. She would come away with no good bargains this day. Matt watched a little play and soon recognized the game. It used 4 dice rather than 2, but without a doubt it was a version of Piri, Match, a game that had been popular for 1,000 years before Arthur Hawkwing began his rise. Small piles of silver had mixed with a few gold coins lay in front of each of the players, and it was a silver mark that he laid in the middle of the table to buy the dice while the stout man was gathering his winnings from the last toss. He expected no trouble from merchants, but trouble was less likely if they lost silver rather than gold. The lean man matched the wager, and Matt rattled the crimson dice in the pewter cup, then spun them out onto the table. They came to rest, showing four fives.
"Is that a winning toss?" Tuan asked.
"Not unless I match it," Matt replied, scooping the dice back into the cup, "without tossing a 14 or the Dark One's eyes first."
The dice clattered in the cup, clattered across the table. Four fives.
His luck was in, for sure. He slid one silver coin over in front of himself and left the other. Abruptly, the graying fellow scraped back his chair and stood up.
"I've had enough," he muttered, and began fumbling the coins in front of him into his coat pockets.
The other two Altarans stared at him incredulously.
"You're leaving, Vane?" the lean man said. "Now?"
"I said I've had enough, Cameron," the graying man growled, and went stumping out into the street, pursued by Cameron's scowl at his back.
The Terror Bonner woman leaned over unsteadily, her beaded braids clicking on the tabletop, to pat the fat man's wrist.
"Just means I'll buy my lacquerware from you, Master Costell," she said fuzzily. "You and Master Cameron."
Costell's triple chins wobbled as he chuckled.
"So it does, Mistress Ulstein. So it does. Doesn't it, Cameron?"
"I suppose," the bald man replied grumpily. "I suppose."
He shoved a mark out to match Matt's. Once again, the dice spun across the table. This time, they came up totaling 14.
"Oh," Tuan said, sounding disappointed. "You lost."
"I won, precious. That's a winning toss if it's your first."
He left his original bet in the middle of the table. "Another?" he said with a grin.
His luck was in, all right, as strong as it had ever been.
The bright red dice rolled across the table, ricocheted across the table, bounced off the wagered coins sometimes, and toss after toss they came to rest, showing 14 white pips. He made 14 every way it could be made. Even at one coin to a wager, the silver in front of him grew to a tidy sum. Half the people in the common room came to stand around the table and watch. He grinned at Tuan, who gave him a slight nod. He had missed this, dice in a common room or tavern, coin on the table, wondering how long his luck would hold, and a pretty woman at his side while he gambled. He wanted to laugh with pleasure. As he was shaking the dice in the cup again, the Terror Bonner merchant glanced at him, and for an instant she did not look drunk at all. Suddenly he no longer felt like laughing. Her face slackened immediately, and her eyes became a tad unfocused once more, but for that instant they had been awls. She had a much better head for wine than he had supposed. It seemed Cameron and Costell would not get away with fobbing off shoddy work at top prices or whatever their scheme had been. What concerned him, though, was that the woman was suspicious of him. Come to think, she herself had not risked a coin against him. The two Altarans were frowning at him, but just the way men who were losing frowned over their bad luck. She thought he had found some way to cheat. Never mind that he was using their dice, or more likely the inn's dice. An accusation of cheating could get a man a drubbing, even in a merchant's inn. Men seldom waited on proof of that charge.
"One last toss," he said, "and I think I'll call it done. Mistress Hyland?"
The innkeeper was among the onlookers. He handed her a small handful of his new won silver coins.
"To celebrate my good fortune, serve everybody what they want to drink until those run out."
That brought appreciative murmurs, and someone behind him clapped him on the back. A man drinking your wine was less likely to believe you had bought it with cheated coin. Or at least they might hesitate long enough to give him a chance to get Tuan out.
"He can't keep this run going forever," Cameron muttered, scrubbing a hand through the hair he no longer possessed. "What say you, Costell? Halves?"
Fingering a gold crown free of the coins piled in front of him, he slid it over beside Matt's silver mark.
"If there's only to be one more toss, let's make a real wager on it. Bad luck has to follow this much good."
Costell hesitated, rubbing his chins in thought, then nodded and added a gold crown of his own. Matt sighed. He could refuse the bet, but walking away now might well trigger Mistress Alstang's charge. So could winning this toss. Reluctantly, he pushed out silver marks to match their gold. That left only two in front of him. He gave the cup an extra heavy shake before spilling the dice onto the table. He did not expect that to alter anything. He was just venting his feelings. The red dice tumbled across the tabletop, hit the piled coins, and bounced back, spinning before they fell to a stop, each showing a single pip. The Dark One's eyes. Laughing just as if it were not just their own coin won back, Cameron and Costell began dividing their winnings. The watchers started drifting away, calling congratulations to the two merchants, murmuring words of commiseration to Matt, some lifting the cup he was paying for in his direction. Mistress Alstaing took a long pull on her wine cup, studying him over the rim, to all outward appearance, as drunk as a goose. He doubted she thought he had been cheating any longer, not when he was walking away with only one mark more than he sat down with. Sometimes bad luck could turn out to be good.
"So your luck is not endless, Toy," Tuan said as he escorted her back to their table. "Or is it that you are lucky only in small things?"
"Nobody has endless luck, Precious. Myself, I think that last toss was one of the luckiest I've ever made." He explained about the Terrabonner woman's suspicions and why he had bought wine for the whole common room. At the table, he held her chair for her, but she remained standing, looking at him.
"You may do very well in Shandar," she said finally, thrusting her nearly empty mug at him. "Guard this until I return."
He straightened in alarm. "Where are you going?" He trusted her not to run away, but not to stay out of trouble without him there to pull her out of it. She put on a long-suffering face. Even that was beautiful.
"If you must know, I am going to the Necessary, Toy."
"Oh, the innkeeper can tell you where it is, or one of the serving women."
"Thank you, Toy," she said sweetly. "I'd never have thought to ask."
She waggled her fingers at Seleucia, and the two of them walked toward the back of the common room, having one of their silent talks and giggling. Sitting down, he scowled into his wine cup. Women seem to enjoy finding ways to make you feel a fool, and he was half married to this one.
"Where are the women?" Tom asked, dropping down into the chair beside Matt and setting a nearly full wine cup on the table.
He grunted when Matt explained, and went on in a low voice, leaning his elbows on the table to put his head close.
"We have trouble behind and ahead. Far enough ahead that it may not bother us here, but best we leave as soon as they return."
Matt sat up straight. "What kind of trouble?"
"Some of those merchant trains that passed us the last few days brought news of a murder in Jurador about the time we left. Maybe a day or two later, it's hard to be sure. A man was found in his own bed with his throat ripped. Only there wasn't enough blood."
He had no need to say more. Matt took a long pull at his wine. The bloody golem was still following him. How had it found out he was with Luca's show? But if it was still a day or two behind at the pace the show was making, likely it would not catch up to him soon. He fingered the silver fox head through his coat. At least he had a way to fight it if it did appear. The thing carried a scar he had given it. And the trouble ahead?
"There's a Shonchen army on the border of Murundi. How they assembled it without my learning about it before this."
He puffed out his mustaches, offended by his failure.
"Well, no matter. Everybody who passes through, they make drink a cup of some herbal tea."
"Tea?" Matt said in disbelief. "Where's the trouble in tea?"
"Every so often this tea makes a woman go unsteady in her legs, and then the Suldam come and collar her. But that's not the worst. They're looking very hard for a slight, dark, young Shonchan woman."
"Well, of course they are. Did you expect they wouldn't be? This solves my biggest problem, Tom. When we get closer, we can leave the show, take to the forest. Tuan and Seleucia can travel on with Luca. Luca will like being the hero who returned their Daughter of the Nine Moons to them." Tom shook his head gravely.
"They're looking for an imposter, Matt. Somebody claiming to be the Daughter of the Nine Moons. Or maybe someone who already has. Except the description fits her too closely. They don't talk about it openly, but there are always men who drink too much, and some always talk too much as well when they do. They mean to kill her when they find her.
something about blotting out the shame she caused.
Light, Matt breathed. How could that be, Tom?
Whatever general commands that army must know her face, wouldn't he? And other officers, too, I'd think. There must be nobles who know her.
Won't do her much good if they do. Even the lowest soldier will slit her throat or bash in her head as soon as she's found. I had that from 3 different merchants, Matt. Even if they're all wrong, are you willing to take the chance?
Matt was not, and over their wine they began planning. Not that they did much drinking. Tom seldom did any more for all his visits to common rooms and taverns, and Matt wanted a clear head.
Luca will scream over letting us have enough horses to mount everyone whatever you pay him, Tom said at one point. And there are pack horses for supplies if we're taking to the forest.
Then I'll start buying, Tom. By the time we have to go, we'll have as many as we need. I'll wager I can find a few good animals right here. Vannon has a good eye, too.
Don't worry, I'll make sure he pays for them. Tom nodded doubtfully. He was not so certain how reformed Vannon was.
A Ludra's coming with us, the white-haired man said in surprise a little later. She'll want to take all her paraphernalia. That'll mean more pack horses.
We have time, Tom. The border of Murundi is a long way yet. I mean to head north into Andor, or east if Vannon knows a way through the mountains.
Better east.
Any way Vannon knew would be a smuggler's path, a horse thief's escape route. There would be much less chance of unfortunate encounters along something like that. The Shonchan could be almost anywhere in Altara, and the way north took him nearer that army than he liked. Tuon and Salusha appeared from the back of the common room, and he stood, taking up Tuon's cloak from her chair. Tom rose too, lifting Salusha's cloak.
We're leaving, Matt said, trying to place the cloak around Tuon. Salusha snatched it out of his hands. I haven't even seen one fight yet, Tuon protested too loudly.
Any number of people turned to stare, merchants and serving women.
I'll explain outside, he told her quietly. Away from prying ears.
Tuon stared up at him expressionless. He knew she was tough, but she was so tiny, like a pretty doll, that it was easy to believe she would break if handled roughly. He was going to do whatever was necessary to make sure she was not put in danger of being broken, whatever it took. Finally, she nodded and let Salusha place the blue cloak on her shoulders. Tom attempted to do the same for the yellow-haired woman, but she took it away from him and donned it herself. Matt could not recall ever seeing her let anyone help her with her cloak. The crooked street outside was empty of human life. A slat-ribbed brown dog eyed them warily, then trotted away around the nearest bend. Matt moved nearly as quickly in the other direction, explaining as they went. If he had expected shock or dismay, he would have been disappointed.
It could be Ravashi or Chimal, the little woman said thoughtfully, as if having an entire Shonchan army out to kill her were no more than an idle distraction. My 2 nearest sisters in age. Our Rana is too young, I think, only 8. 14, you would say. Chimal is quiet in her ambition, but Ravashi has always believed she should be named just because she is older. She might well have sent someone to plant rumors should I disappear for a time. It is really quite clever of her, if she is the one.
Just as coolly as talking about whether it might rain.
This plot could be dealt with easily if the High Lady were in the Terrasen Palace where she belongs, Salusha said, and coolness vanished from Tuon.
Oh, her face became as chill as that of an executioner, but she rounded on her maid, fingers flashing so furiously they should have been striking sparks. Salusha's face went pale, and she sank to her knees, head down and huddling. Her fingers gestured briefly, and Tuon let her own hands fall, stood looking down at the scarf-covered top of Salusha's head, breathing heavily. After a moment, she bent and lifted the other woman to her feet. Standing very close, she said something very short in that finger talk. Salusha replied silently. Tuon made the same gestures again, and they exchanged tremulous smiles. Tears glistened in their eyes. Tears.
Will you tell me what that was all about? Matt demanded.
They turned their heads to study him.
What are your plans, Toy? Tuon asked at last.
Not Ebu Dar, if that's what you're thinking, Precious. If one army is out to kill you, then they probably all are. And there are too many soldiers between here and Ebu Dar. But don't worry. I'll find some way to get you back safely.
So you always...
Her eyes went past him, widening, and he looked over his shoulder to see 7 or 8 men round the last bend in the street. Every man had an unsheathed sword in his hand. Their steps quickened at sight of him.
"Run, Tuan!"
he shouted, spinning to face their attackers. "Tom, get her away from here!" A knife came into either hand from his sleeves, and he threw them almost at once. The left-hand blade took a graying man in the eye, the right hand a skinny fellow in the throat. They dropped as if their bones had melted, but before their swords clattered on the paving stones, he had already snatched another pair of knives from his boot tops and was sprinting toward them. It took them by surprise, losing 2 of their number so quickly and him closing the distance instead of trying to flee. But with him so close so quickly, and them jamming against one another on that narrow street, they lost most of the advantage that swords gave them over his knives. Not all, unfortunately. His blades could deflect a sword, but he only bothered when someone drew back for a thrust. In short order, he had a fine collection of gashes across his ribs, on his left thigh, along the right side of his jaw, a cut that would have laid open his throat had he not jerked aside in time. But had he tried to flee, they would have run him through from behind. Alive and bleeding was better than dead. His hands moved as fast as they ever had, short moves, almost delicate. Flamboyance would have killed him. One knife slipped into a fat man's heart and out again before the fellow's knees began to crumple. He sliced inside the elbow of a man built like a blacksmith, who dropped his sword and awkwardly drew his belt knife with his left hand. Matt ignored him. The fellow was already staggering from blood loss before his blade cleared the scabbard. A square-faced man gasped as Matt sliced open the side of his neck. He clapped a hand to the wound, but he only managed to totter back 2 steps before he fell. As men died, the others gained room, but Matt moved faster still, dancing so that a falling man shielded him from another's sword while he closed inside the sword arc of a third. To him, the world consisted of his 2 knives and the men crowding each other to get at him, and his knives sought the places where men bleed most heavily. Some of those ancient memories came from men who had not been very nice at all. And then, miracle of miracles, bleeding profusely, but his blood too hot to let him feel the full pain yet, he was facing the last, one he had not noticed before. She was young and slim in a ragged dress, and she might have been pretty had her face been clean, had her teeth not been showing in a rictus snarl. The dagger she was tossing from hand to hand had a double-edged blade 2x the length of his hand. "You can't hope to finish alone what the others failed in together," he told her. "Run. I'll let you go unharmed." With a cry like a feral cat, she rushed at him, slashing and stabbing wildly. All he could do was dance backwards, awkwardly, trying to fend her off. His boot slid in a patch of blood, and as he staggered, he knew he was about to die. Abruptly, Tuan was there, left hand seizing the young woman's wrist, not the wrist of her knife hand, worse luck, twisting, so the arm went stiff and the girl was forced to double over. And then it mattered not at all which hand held her knife, because Tuan's right hand swept across, bladed like an axe, and struck her throat so hard that he heard the cartilage cracking. Choking, she clutched her ruined throat and sagged to her knees, then fell over, still sucking hoarsely for breath. "I told you to run," Matt said, not sure which of the 2 he was addressing.
"You very nearly let her kill you, Toy," Tuan said severely. "Why?"
"I promised myself I'd never kill another woman," he said wearily. His blood was beginning to cool, and light he hurt. "Looks like I've ruined this coat," he muttered, fingering one of the blood-soaked slashes. The motion brought a wince. When had he been gashed on the left arm? Her gaze seemed to bore into his skull, and she nodded as if she had come to some conclusion. Tom and Seleucia were standing a little down the street, in front of the reason Tuan was still there, better than 6 bodies sprawled in the paving stones. Tom had a knife in either hand and was allowing Seleucia to examine a wound on his ribs through the rent in his coat. Oddly, by the evidence of the dark glistening patches on his coat, he seemed to have fewer injuries than Matt. Matt wondered whether Tuon had taken part there, too, but he could not see a spot of blood on her anywhere. Seleucia had a bloody gash down her left arm, though it appeared not to hinder her.
"I am an old man," Tom said suddenly, "and sometimes I imagine I see things that can't be. But luckily, I always forget them."
Seleucia paused to look up at him coolly. Lady's maid she might be, but blood seemed not to faze her at all.
"And what might you be trying to forget?"
"I can't recall," Tom replied.
Seleucia nodded and went back to examining his wounds. Matt shook his head. Sometimes he was not entirely sure Tom still had all his wits. For that matter, Seleucia seemed to shovel shy of a full load now and then, too.
"This one can't live to be put to the question," Tuon drawled, frowning at the woman choking and twitching at her feet. "And she can't talk if she somehow managed to."
Bending fluidly, she scooped up the woman's knife and drove it hard beneath the woman's breastbone. That rasping fight for air went silent. Glazing eyes stared up at the narrow strip of sky overhead.
"A mercy she did not deserve, but I see no point to needless suffering. I won, Toy."
"You won? What are you talking about?"
"You used my name before I used yours, so I won."
Matt whistled faintly through his teeth.
Whenever he thought he knew how tough she was, she found a way to show him he did not know the half. If anybody happened to be looking out a window, that stabbing might raise questions with the local magistrate, probably Lord Nathan himself. But there were no faces at any window he could see. People avoided getting embroiled in this sort of thing if they could. For all he knew, any number of porters or barrow men might have come along during the fight. For a certainty, they would have turned right around again as quickly as they could. Whether any might have gone for Lord Nathan's guards was another question. Still, he had no fear of Nathan or his magistrate. A pair of men escorting two women did not decide to attack more than a dozen carrying swords. Likely these fellows and the unfortunate young woman were well known to the guards. Limping to retrieve his thrown knives, he paused in the act of pulling the blade from the graying man's eye. He had not really taken in that face before. Everything had happened too quickly for more than general impressions. Carefully wiping the knife on the man's coat, he tucked it away up his sleeve as he straightened.
"Our plans have changed, Tom. We're leaving Matter in as fast as we can, and we're leaving the show as fast as we can. Luca will want to be rid of us so much that he'll let us have all the horses we need." "This must be reported, Toy," Tuon said severely. "Failure to do so is as lawless as what they did."
"You know that fellow?" Tom said.
Matt nodded.
"His name is Vane, and I don't think anybody in this town will believe a respectable merchant attacked us in the street. Luca will give us horses to be rid of this."
It was very strange. The man had not lost a coin to him, had not wagered a coin. So why?
Very strange indeed. And reason enough to be gone quickly.